Hello and welcome back to Tabling the Podcast. My name is Ariana Karp, and this week I am joined by Matt Ball, Patrick Harvey, Samantha Blinn, and Chasen Schneider as we work our way through the third act of King Henry IV, Part 1. A few of the topics of discussion include the fact that Glendower doesn't snap at Hotspur, demonstrating Hotspur's power as a rallying point for the rebellion, Glendower as the Welsh Renaissance man, Shakespeare's satirical demonstration of the somewhat comical chivalric love between Lady Mortimer and Mortimer versus the more down-to-earth, playful relationship between Lady Percy and Hotspur, Worcester's shrewd political maneuverings in the rebel camp, and the directorial challenge of demonstrating the power of the rebels while simultaneously showing their disorder and squabbling. Henry IV's mistake is that he equates the celebrity that Richard II cultivated with the populism that Hal cultivates in his daily life. Hal's vow and the disturbing violence of his promise, the second tavern scene as a much more melancholic scene than the first one, Falstaff listless and bored until Hal comes back to the tavern, and the wonderful confusion and sassiness of Mistress Quickly and her perpetual defensiveness. Thank you so much for listening, and we hope you enjoy this week's edition of Tabling the Podcast, Act 3 of King Henry IV, Part 1. And welcome back to Tabling the Podcast. My name is Ariana Karp, and this week I'm joined by
Matt Ball,
Patrick Harvey,
Samantha Blinn.
Amazing. All right, so we just read through Act 3 of King Henry IV, Part 1. And we were discussing this a little bit. So this sort of, it goes back to something that I talked about in the introduction where we see all these different worlds. And in this act, much like the first act, we visit each one of those worlds. So first we start off in the rebel camp. I always think of it as a camp. It doesn't have to be. And then we go to the king's court. And then we go back to the tavern. So we have all three worlds in one act. So did anything stick out to you particularly about any one of the scenes or any one of the characters as we were reading it? I have a couple things written down, but...
The first thing I noticed was that Hotspur does most of this of Act 1, Act 3, Scene 1 in prose. Or he does part of it. Parts of it.
Mm.
Just like from a textual point, I've got the art in here, and it points out that like some editions have it as prose, some have it as verse.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Mostly like to fill up space. But that, like, he speaks... the point is that in the beginning of the scene, he speaks irregularly for his first line, and then his response to Glendower, why so it would have been this in the same season as your mother's cat had been kittened.
Yeah.
Loved it.
That's a great line.
I get the sense that, like, he's out of his element around Glendower.
Yeah.
Like, he's not an easy speaker in any case.
Yeah.
But that something about having Glendower around really throws him off.
Yeah.
Well, you know, and he's being moody and deflecting everything, too.
Yeah. Well, we've seen him be moody already.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
In the two other scenes that we've seen him, he's been very moody and changeable.
Mm-hmm.
And also, like, so bad at being a political figure.
Yeah.
Like, it's my favorite thing. Like, they come in, it's like this very serious thing, and he's like, oh, fuck, I forgot the map! You know, instead of being like, could somebody please get the map? He, like, just loses it completely.
Yeah, totally
he shows all
shit.
Of his cards in his first line.
Yeah.
A plague upon it! I forgot the map! You know, it's hilarious. It's, like, so telling. And Glendower's like, no, here it is. Everyone sit. I'm in charge, you know? And so it's really funny, like, how easily it is to rile him up. But yet he still commands respect. And when you were doing that Mortimer speech, comes after Glendower exits,
it tells you so much both about Glendower and Hotspur,
yeah,
I think, because he's
yeah.
he says, you know, he holds your temper in a high respect and curbs himself even of his natural scope. So Glendower is like holding back. Like, no one has ever lived who's gotten this pissed off at Glendower
yeah.
before
yeah.
in his face. And I think that tells you a lot about what Hotspur means to England, and it tells you a lot about how powerful Glendower is.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, it's a really high-stakes meeting, and Hotspur just keeps fucking it up. And then telling us that he doesn't actually care
yeah.
how much land he gets. He just, like, wants to best him.
Yeah.
Which is, like, a horrible non-cooperative tactic in this huge, like, negotiation.
I've got a question. Later on,
yeah.
later on in the battle, Hotspur's teamed with the Scottish.
Yeah.
Now, Glendower doesn't... Is Glendower not... He doesn't show up?
He doesn't show up.
He doesn't show up along with Northumberland.
Once again, the same way, which actually makes me think that Glendower is the Welsh captain that appears in Richard II in just one scene.
Mm.
Because he has very similar language, and he's like, ah, the yew trees in our countries are withered, and, like, meteors are there, and we're not going, it's bad omen. And the same thing happens
yeah.
in this play, where there's, like, bad omens, the Welsh don't go, which is probably a good thing that they don't go for them, because they probably would have lost if they had gone, because Hotspur's side lost.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, would they have won if the Welsh had showed up?
Mm-hmm.
So he is very much into mysticism and poetry, but at the same time, he's also this, like, fierce warrior who has led successful uprisings against the king twice
mm-hmm.
already. So it's this, he's such an interesting character, and it's, I always think it's such a disappointment that he's only in this one scene, because he's such a character, and, like, he has such a self-aggrandizing way of kind of...
Yeah.
Like, announcing himself, and...
I love the whole English-Welsh bit.
Oh, yeah, it's so
English,
good.
I speak English, Lord, as well as you, for I was trained in the English court, you know?
Yeah.
It's great.
And
it's
Hotspur's,
so English, so
yeah.
nationalist.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And he's like, and I know poetry, and you don't, Hotspur. It's just so good. It's so good. I love it. He's like, I can be a warrior and a scholar. You can only be one, you know. That's sort of the implication that I get from that. I kind of feel like Glendower is the Renaissance man a little bit. Like, he plays music, he's sort of mystical,
mm-hmm.
he's this warrior, and he speaks multiple languages. It's just
sort of like this mystic druid.
He considers himself
yeah.
one, at least, you know.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Just like a fierce druid.
And it's like there's certain, I think there's certain aspects of Glendower that, like, Percy is drawn to, like the,
yeah.
the battle aspect.
Yeah.
But he's later going to get that from Douglas.
Yeah.
And there are certain, like, the mystical element. Like, he's described by Falstaff, he says, the fiend Douglas and the devil Glendower.
Yeah.
Like, that's the big difference, is
yeah.
Hotspur feels more at home with, like, a fierce, manic fiend warrior.
Yeah.
Than, like, a fearsome devil that he can't control.
I've always seen Douglas portrayed as, like, like, giant,
yeah.
big muscle meathead kind of guy,
yeah.
which I always find really funny. I don't know. It's just like, I'm gonna kill every one of the king's counterfeits.
Yeah, he's the
I'm
muscle.
Yeah,
he's
and it's
muscle.
Just really, it's really funny because you think, like, you've seen the warrior in Hotspur, and then, like, Douglas shows up, and you're like, oh, shit.
Yeah,
there's
the
another guy.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I like the idea that Hotspur is just baiting him this whole scene.
Mm-hmm.
And that maybe is his tactic, is he's just like trying to push the boundary, see how far he can go.
Yeah.
It's also interesting to me, this is the only scene that Mortimer appears in.
Yeah.
And Mortimer is the one who was declared the actual heir. So it really, it could be a play about more, like, that's ostensibly why they're rebelling, is to put Mortimer on the throne, and he only appears in this one scene.
Good point, yeah.
And is sort of, like, not that big of a character. He gets talked about a lot, but he only shows up in this one scene of the two parts of Henry. So it's very interesting. I wonder why that is. Maybe there was some family... something.
If there was, or if the writer just thought maybe the story of Percy is more compelling.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
I don't know how many liberties he took actually keeping, you know, the Welsh side of things out. He just thought,
yeah,
well, it's easier to just marry Mortimer off.
Yeah.
And then he's out of the story.
Yeah.
And then, you know, in the sequel, we can focus on the Archbishop.
Yeah. That's a very good point. Yeah.
I don't know.
And, I just love Mortimer and Lady Mortimer's relationship. It's like the perfect relationship. They can't understand each other, so
yeah,
they just gaze longingly at each other.
Yeah.
It's like, oh my god, perfect. there's never going to be
no
an argument.
Talking.
No
required.
Talking aloud. I always find that part quite funny. It's supposed to be very, I think it's supposed to be very romantic, but I always just find it hilarious that she's like speaking in Welsh and he's
yeah,
like, I got nothing. Like, I don't know what you're saying.
Yeah, it's so
but I
funny.
Love you so much. It's like, it's such a great, yeah.
It's very odd and very telling the way they've fetishized the Welsh woman.
Oh,
and the,
yeah.
You know, and the music and
oh,
all of
yeah,
that. It's I think it's definitely meant to be satirical, you know? It's like,
I think so,
yeah,
too,
it's
yeah.
Very funny. Like these
and Lady Percy just like not having it either.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, the Percys are set up as a foil to them.
Oh yeah.
As like a much, much more real, I think they're like the couple that the audience can relate to, like just
oh, yeah,
the bickering, joking, just like can't
mm-hmm,
sit still. Like he wants to reach over to start tickling her, just
yeah,
to piss everyone off.
Yeah, I think so.
But like that is also quite touching about them.
It
I
is.
Think.
It's
yeah,
such a good relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and hey, you've now done all of Lady Percy.
I've now done officially all of Lady Percy. Because
I directed Samantha doing the first Lady Percy scene from this one,
yeah,
from the Oh My Good Lord, Why Are You Thus
yeah,
Alone? And then she also did the one in part two where Lady Percy is
yeah,
urging Northumberland.
Back to
so,
back.
And then, so
that was emotional.
That
was
really,
like,
yeah, that was fun. That
was
a fun transition.
Over the face.
But then,
yeah,
so this is the only other scene that she appears in. And she's so fun. I love the idea that she's, like, trying to keep all proper, and he's just like, come on, Kate, sing. And she's like, fuck off.
Yeah.
You know? It's, like,
yeah,
so good.
So good.
And the whole thing about, like, now God help thee to the Welsh lady's bed. She's like, what?
Say it again?
What?
She's
so
singing.
Good.
Stop it, she's singing.
Yeah, exactly.
She
it's
sings.
Just such a, it's such a playful,
It is. It's a relatable...
Yeah.
Oh my god, yes.
Yeah.
It's Jim and Pam.
It's Jim and Pam! That's why I like it so much.
Hey,
that's
hey,
great.
Jason.
Hi, and Jason just joined us. Welcome.
Sorry for being so late.
Oh, no, it's all good. Have a seat. We're talking about Act 3. So, yeah, so we have this,
oh,
this great yeah, bit with... we have this great bit with Percy's. And then... we also get in this scene, I like that we have this theme of Hotspur being scolded
mm-hmm,
by both Worcester and Mortimer,
mm-hmm,
which is
Worcester's
quite
like, yo, you
fun,
need to like chill out for a second.
Yeah.
You're going a little crazy.
But
let's...
again, yeah, like Worcester is the best politician,
mm-hmm,
right? He has the best political
yeah,
advice. And he even the way he says it to Hotspur is very... diplomatic, like he's such a good diplomat, like he you know sometimes you need to learn how do I say this, you know, like it's very his language is so different from everyone else
too.
Yeah,
here we go,
like sometimes it may seem like you're doing the right thing but usually this is what it appears to everyone else. So if you could just tone it all down, like, a little bit, it would be really great.
We would really appreciate it.
Yeah. So I like the fact that we already see, this is the first time, really, we're seeing the full coalition of the rebels, and we already see it splintering.
They're a
you know,
mess.
It's
they're
already,
a
yeah,
total
they're a
mess.
Total mess. But yet they're still kind of threatening in a way. So I think it's a funny thing, like as a director, to try and balance. Of course, they're going to be there's this not quite unity within the group. Like they're fighting over territory essentially before they've even won it. But at the same time, they're also definitely a power to be reckoned with. Otherwise, everyone wouldn't be so nervous about it.
Mm.
So I think that's a fun thing to sort of try and negotiate. Also, Lady My Brach is a really great name. Instead of saying bitch, we should all just say brach. Oh man, she's being such a brach. Just wanted to put that out there. Words we should use more often. Cool. Did anyone have any other observations about that that first scene in Act 3?
Is there any... I love going on little tangents about maybe what the author intended, but I remember when you tabled King Lear talking about the danger at the beginning of the play of dividing the kingdom.
Yeah.
And how that that same danger is sort of presaged in this scene.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Maybe there's a hinting, especially in the wake of the Essex
Rebellion. Yeah.
That there's a danger in a divided England.
Yeah.
So I think the suggestion of that is still, it's kind of like, it's a bit taboo for an audience at the time to have seen. Maybe.
Absolutely. No. I mean, and that was the thing about, so this is before, this was written during Elizabeth's reign. So we didn't have the idea of unity as much.
Mm.
And just to sort of recap what we talked about a little bit in King Lear is that so often King Lear is like, yes, he's dividing his kingdom. It's the most natural thing ever because it's the start of the play. Actually, dividing the kingdom is a terribly politically dangerous thing to do. And I think we need to feel that at the beginning of King Lear for the play to work.
As we see now. With the Brexit.
Absolutely.
That's a perfect example.
Absolutely. Yeah. And like Scotland's like, we're out, man. We're out.
Yeah.
But the idea actually of Great Britain kind of initiated with James I, who was the king of Scotland and England. He was James VI of Scotland and James I of England. And he was very, very invested in the idea of a Great Britain, which is where we get this idea, or United Kingdom. And the rest of the country was not at all. The Scots didn't like it. It was an incredibly unpopular idea. But I think you see with a lot of Shakespeare's Jacobean plays, the idea that unity is much more important than chaos. I think he was doing that in order to sort of flatter James I. But I think legitimately that was a huge Elizabethan fear, as well as chaos is sort of the highest evil, right? This is why at the end of every single Shakespeare play, we have to regroup and we have to reestablish order. It doesn't matter how bad we've gotten. It's like every tragedy, highest ranking, still alive character always has the last line. So you're like, oh, order has been restored.
Mm-hmm.
Even though we just had this crazy rebellion against a king, Macbeth, Malcolm is going to be our new king and he will restore order. So he gets the last line.
It's like a wedding.
Absolutely.
Of politics.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, we have to reestablish order. And you know, I've said this multiple times before, but one of my favorite things as a modern director is seeing how we can even find to destabilize the end of every play. Because I think that's a sort of postmodern idea that's much more interesting than reestablishing order, is seeing where the cracks are in the order that has ostensibly been established. But I think it's dangerous what they're doing. Everything they've done has been dangerous. Like, they initiate their idea of rebelling in the throne room.
Mm-hmm.
Like, in the throne room. They're like, I think we should overthrow the king. In the throne room! Like, there's no... It's so dangerous, everything that they're doing. And I think there should be a feeling of weight to this scene. Otherwise, I think we lose the stakes of the play a little bit, you know?
It could be done in a way where it's ineffectual, where, this scene starts and they're having that birth argument and your mother's cat was kittened and all this and that. But it just doesn't, it doesn't hold any weight that way. It has to feel dangerous.
Yeah.
Like Douglas can feel ridiculous and like the muscle in the scene in the background, but it has to feel more imminent than that for the play to work. I think so, too.
And I think, you know, maybe, and that word divide... It's a very distinctive word. I don't think you get it in Shakespeare that often. Actually, Hotspur says it in his scene with Lady Percy. Mm-hmm. I could divide myself, which is a very interesting use of that word. But I think, you know, the first time instead of it being like a transition word, like Glendower being like, all right, come, let's divide the map. If it's like, no, real business, let's divide the map. As in, like, this is what we're here to do, is divide the territory. And if that becomes the sort of driving force of the scene, I think it'll hopefully give it, you know, a little bit of weight. And interesting to me that the women are going to the war to go meet the men. Just because I don't feel like you see that in other plays. Like Glendower says that Lady Mortimer wants to go with them to battle. And everyone's like, whoa, no way. I think that's quite unusual for a female character to go into battle. The only one I can think of is Joan.
And she's actually, like, fighting.
And she's fighting. yeah, very interesting. So I guess moving on to the scene with the king and Prince Hal. This is quite a whopper of a scene. It's incredibly long speeches. Definitely, it has the longest speech in the play. And Henry is sort of categorized, or sort of characterized, rather, by, I think, his long speeches. He has even longer ones in part two, I think, in that scene when he dies. Very, very long speeches, with tiny little interjections from Prince Hal. And so I think, I don't know if it would be useful for you guys, but to just sort of divide the scene up into, like, what happens in each one of these speeches. Because I think sometimes that can be, I thought Patrick, you did a great job of, like, getting us, like, through what's going on and, like, making it clear. And also the pacing was, like, awesome. So now I just want to go back and sort of figure out what is going on with each of these sort of beats in the in his speeches. Mm-hmm. Something that I noticed also, just to throw this out here, is his use of sound. And the way you did it really brought home to me. He uses S's a lot. And C's. And it's...
And alliteration.
Yes, yeah, so much alliteration. And assonance and consonants. And that just struck me as like a very raw thing from these speeches. Slept in his face and rendered such aspects. Sick, shine seldom, sun-like, shallow gestures, seldom but sumptuous, showed like a feast.
Yeah, he's
really, really interesting. And then those K and C sounds, the skipping king.
Yeah.
It's like he you can hear his mood changing in the sound of the words that he's saying. Companion to the common streets. You know, it's fascinating to me. I didn't really notice that before.
As a reader, it is so much fun to lean into those two.
Oh yeah.
Like you just spit those out. That's a blast.
Absolutely.
Like you build up momentum with them. Like they really do carry you through the speech.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting the first thing he does is send everyone out of the room.
Yeah.
But tell them to stay nearby. Mm-hmm. In the Arden it says, it asks the question, does the king fear some attack from his son? Hollinshed reports the rumors that reached the king's ears that his son would presume to usurp the crown and wished him harm. Or is he merely alerting the prince that he has other business and doesn't have much time to devote to him?
Wow.
Right?
Either way, it's totally a political move,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Again, and he's such a political king.
And he starts by saying, you know, why do you think I've brought you here? So what do you think you're doing here today?
Yeah.
You know? And I think Hal's first attempt, like his first instinct is to, like, I'll come clean with my dad. I'll be the good son.
Yeah.
And, you know, kind of like an aw shucks, I wish
Dad, we're famous. People are going to talk.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly.
it's very interesting. I always found... I remember when I first did this many years ago. It actually makes me feel incredibly old thinking about how long ago I first learned this. There's so many. It's very awkwardly phrased, the first Prince Hal speech. The commas are, yeah, mm-hmm. It's very, like, disjointed. Like, the thought doesn't end, it rarely ends at the end of a line mm-hmm. in this first speech. Like, I found his like, do not think so speech, like, so much clearer.
Yeah,
this first one, I feel like, it's like, they don't know how to talk to each other. Like, he just, and I've said this before, I think King Henry, like, just doesn't know how to relate to his sons. Mm-hmm. He's just one of those dads that's just sort of like, hi.
It's a classic father-son. They can't get on the same
level.
Yeah.
The way you mentioned talking in Act One about how Henry speaks in a lot of... He uses a lot of images in his speech and a lot of metaphors. Like, he just kind of personifies the things he's talking about, the hot vengeance and the rod of heaven.
Yeah.
You know, God's doom. He's very religious, but he's kind of fire and brimstone.
He is a bit,
and I think
he,
in the first bit, he intimidates Hal into matching him in that tone. But I think Henry's not interested in being appeased.
Yeah.
He wants sort of, what's the term?
He wants him to change. It's like...
Yeah, atonement.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Because it's so interesting at the end of, you know, Hal's thing, he's like, you should pardon me. And he's like, God, pardon me.
Yeah.
Like, I have no time for pardons. You know, it's such a...
it's really examining.
It's a lot of antithesis in
God
in
pardon
this.
Thee, let me wonder.
Yeah.
You know,
God can pardon thee. I'm going to still be like,
I've still got
how are
questions.
You my son, essentially.
You're not getting out of this so easily.
Yeah.
And the speeches are so long.
They're so long.
There's nothing really that complex about his beef here. With
no.
Scene.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of a one-note scene, but so why does he get so much stage time? What do you think? Like, why does it need so much explication?
Almost think it's like previously on the history plays a little bit in this speech where he's literally like telling his side of the story from Richard II.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's like
previously
that's
a great read of it.
On Richard II.
On the
Hall of X, Y, and Z.
Yeah, exactly. Because he's like, and it's like, so this is his argument, right? You have lost your place in council. You become an alien to the court. The hope and expectation of your time is ruined, and everyone thinks you're going to fail. And then that's like the first like 10 lines.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of the speech is him talking about him versus Richard, which was the entire previous play.
Uh-huh.
So it's literally like, this is why I became king, because I was not what Richard was. And I think his huge confusion, this is what I wrote down, I think Henry's misunderstanding of Hal stems from his confusion that being popular and a celebrity versus Hal's populism, which are two very different things. Like, Hal is, in my reading of the play, Hal wants to know the people he's eventually going to rule, which is why he...
Spends
so much time at the tavern. And like, yes, he likes them and everything, but I also think he's a great observer, and he's trying to understand people in a way that no one in the royal family has ever tried.
It's jiving with the beardless boys.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
He hates
and Richard was totally different. Richard was an elitist. Richard had all these favorites that he would give money to, and it was very corrupt, and he was seen like a celebrity, but he didn't interact with anyone. He didn't, like, make connections with the common people. He's just talking about how... So I think that's Henry's confusion. That's his big confusion, is essentially... He thinks that Hal is becoming a celebrity by being seen all the time, when Hal is actually... He's sort of infamous now for just hanging around the tavern. And, you know, Richard II would never have done that, but he sort of equates the two things that are dissimilar. And that to me is like their biggest misunderstanding.
But and to go on that, he can't actually say, he spends his whole speech going around the question, like he can't actually say what the problem is until he's just like, until he explains the whole situation with Richard, and then he says, "You're being Richard."
Yeah, exactly.
And the way I was being is what Hotspur is being now.
Yeah. It's like
that's
he has
it.
To spell it out in
that's
the last
the fucking
speech.
Problem,
yeah. Yeah, because you're right. He doesn't actually say, he doesn't talk about Hal after those first 10 lines of that speech.
Yeah.
The rest of it is about himself,
mm-hmm.
literally. Until he says at the end, he's like, that's sort of like what you are. And then he spells it out much more thoroughly.
It's a thing where it's like a powerful dad, especially back then, considering the different views of like fatherhood and what a son's supposed to carry on. It's like, you know, you're in that position, you want your son to be you. And, you know, when you find out that your son's not you, it's because he starts talking about himself and Richard, because it's like, you were supposed to be me, and you're not, you know? You're the opposite of me.
Absolutely. Well, and I think he crosses a line, because I'm always like, why doesn't Hal interrupt him earlier? And I think it has to be this build up to, you know, why am I telling you this? You're probably going to join Hotspur, and you're going to fight against me, and you're going to flatter him, and you're going to, and that's like, that is the final straw. But I always, that was always something that I was like, he just lets him trash him.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's like, he has to finally talk. Because, like, I get the feeling that Henry probably could have gone on for another 2 weeks, the rate he's going.
Yeah.
And so it's like, there has to be something different about the way that he says those last couple lines before Hal just, like, explodes. You know, I think there has to be something that just kind of clicks.
I think there's something in a father calling his oldest son a degenerate.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Like, the word itself is just
a degeneration of her family line.
Yeah, he like
her
he's
legacy.
Disowning him with that line.
Yeah.
You know?
Absolutely. And he has four sons. That's what
mm-hmm.
I always find like extraordinary about Henry is like he was blessed to have four sons, which is pretty much the best thing you could possibly have in those times. It's like, oh my God, if one dies, I got another one, and if he dies, I've got another one, and if he dies, I've got another one. Like it's like quadruple security on your succession.
Mm-hmm.
It's just remarkable.
Do not think so. You shall not find it. So your reading of that was great.
Oh.
Like, that's such a crazy... Yeah, I mean, how do you respond to that? Your father calling you a degenerate.
Well,
that's
and I love how simple his language
mm-hmm.
is. At the right, like, it's
you
all
get
these
that.
Monosyllabic
yeah.
words.
Yeah.
Do not think so. You shall not find it. So, like, well, and in mine, because it's the RSC edition, and I sort of changed everything back to God, because they have heaven in
mm-hmm.
here, because they couldn't print God in the folio, and they sort of have gone back to the but and heaven forgive them is so much less powerful than and God forgive them that so much have swayed.
Yeah.
I also just like the second line of this, like, you know, I think it's so clear his Hal's thesis at the beginning of that speech, but then I almost think it's like amazement at the power of rumor and the power that the king has been swayed essentially by these counselors who are like, your son is lost. And he's just like, holy shit.
Yeah.
Like, wow, I really need to check in a little bit more often. And I think that to me connects to his first speech where he's like, you know, you're the king. So you're always going to hear people exaggerating things and trying to get, you know, favors from you. So, you know, they've exaggerated a little. And then it's like, wow, they've really won you over to their perspective.
Yeah.
And I always think that's like such, that could be such a sad moment.
He's putting out a similar trap that Richard fell in, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Of surrounding himself with, you know, flatterers and counselors.
Yeah. That's an excellent point. And I always, you know, we've talked about the sort of trouble with Hal and how he has sometimes been interpreted as like a sort of pure Machiavellian character, which I think is just really a shallow reading of him. And like, he's a difficult character because I think of the first speech he has in that first scene where he's like, I know you all in Willow Wallopold and blah, 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 and I'm going to be great. Don't worry, audience. And then this speech where he's like talking about what he's going to do to Hotspur. Because that's a little bit, to me, that's like a little like, whoa. Because basically what he's saying is like, I've let Hotspur do all this shit because I'm going to kill him. And then all of his good deeds are going to become my good deeds because that's the way chivalry works. And that's like a really difficult concept, I think, for us to kind of philosophically work around. Was this idea that if you killed a great warrior, all of their renowned deeds became yours because you overcame them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a really, I find it a very disturbing concept. That he'll render every single title and honor that he's won to Hal when Hal kills him in battle. And then basically he's saying, but for me the redeeming part is at the end, he's like, well, if I don't do this, I'll be dead, so you won't care anyway. You know, it's a little bit like, what?
Yeah.
Dude! But it's the first time I think we see like the shimmer of Henry V a bit.
Totally.
And like his sort of force in, like when he's at Harfleur, and it's the Once More Into the Breach, and the way he talks to the governor about how all of his soldiers are essentially, they're going to rape all of the women and kill all the old men. And it's kind of this terrifying power. And I always get the sense that he's just saying this in order to, it's like an intimidation thing, but it doesn't stop the fact that it's like a terrifying thing what he's saying. And I sort of get a shimmer of that in this speech of like, I know what I'm doing, and I'm going to kill him. And there's something really cold about it that I've always found a bit disturbing.
It reminds me a bit, I'm going to make a Game of Thrones reference. In the last season when Jaime meets with, what's his name?
The Blackfish guy?
Oh. No, his nephew, Catelyn's brother.
Oh, yeah.
And he says, here's what I'm going to do if you don't get in this castle. I'm going to take your child, and I'm going to catapult him into the battlements.
Yeah.
And then after that, I'm going to master you. And you're like, we've spent the entire season getting to like him, but
then
when
like,
it comes
oh,
down,
right.
When it comes down to like the coldness of war, it's like, nope, I'm going to do what has to be done.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You're a tiny fraction of me. I'm a better man than you.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also like, I have more strategic power than you will ever have, and I'm the boss here, and I have a job to do, and I'll do my job.
Yeah.
And there's something very reptilian, I think, about that. And that's, again, that's why I love it, because the next scene, we see him goofing off and talking about tavern stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like something's changed.
Yeah.
Something is completely changed in him, and this tavern scene is very much more melancholy than the last tavern scene we saw them in.
His relationship with Falstaff has completely
changed. Yeah.
You gotta tell him you're going to war.
Yeah.
You're going to war.
Well, and I always love that even though it's like you're going to war, it's also like, oh, by the way, I made you a foot soldier. Ah, fatty. You know, and Falstaff is like, fuck you, why couldn't I have a horse? You know, it's like, it's such a great, so even though there's this, there is, I think, a much more melancholy tone, and I think summed up so perfectly in that last line, that I could wish this tavern were my drum. There's something, something's changed. I always think the beginning of this scene with, like, Bardolph and Falstaff is, like, very sort of melancholy.
Sad.
They're just, like...
just so pathetic and fat in the tavern.
Yeah.
Just, like, waiting for Hal to come back.
Yeah.
And he does, and...
Falstaff especially, because he's trying to trade wit with Bardolph, and
it's like,
you are not funny. You are not as funny as
Hal. No, he's chasing a joke. He, like, really... Yeah. He's, like, kind of chasing his tail around with that lantern speech.
Oh,
like,
my God, yes.
Oh, my God. That
it's
speech is
so...
so I don't
so
know what to
long.
Do with it. It's so hard, and he's, like, fumbling over himself, and it's...
throws in all these Latin words, too.
Yeah,
like, in
Ignis
Fatuus, and everyone's, like, what are you... Well, come on.
Are you talking
do
about
the other
funny,
thing? Talk about the 9 turning into 11 turning into 15.
And then the hostess comes in and goes, Hey, I've got a thing to talk about
well,
with you.
Get my pocket.
And she goes, no one picks your pocket. And he's like, oh my God, help me out. I have no one to talk to. My life is meaningless.
Yeah,
it's
he's
so
in a bad
true.
Spot.
For fuck's sake.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And his buddy Hal comes back.
Yeah. Marching. I always think it's It's like he has a costume change a bit. Like Hal comes in like armor and he's like ready to go. Like right before he, mm-hmm. it's like right before he's going out and he's just like, bye everyone. I always think this should be like a really kind of tearful scene at the end. But yeah, I also just love, it's such a great image. The image of like the, my skin hangs about me like an old lady's loose gown, which is just, like, such a good line. And then it's just, like, Bardolph with, like, this bright red beacon of a face. Like, it's such a great image of just this, these two guys just sitting there. They're both, like,
sick,
caricatured drunk, as, like,
yeah.
like diseased.
Inflamed
man, yeah.
red face.
Yeah. It's so, oh, my God. The
too
night of the
wine.
Burning lamp. Oh my God. I also love this Falstaff, like he's such an equivocator, right? He was like, I swore little, I dice not more than once a day. I went to a body house once in a quarter of an hour. You know, it's like all of these things. I paid money that I borrowed a couple times. Not all the time. You know, it's like he keeps making these statements
but
and then undercutting them with like, well, let me
yeah,
qualify
that. It's like
that.
He can't help but be honest even
yeah.
when he's trying to cover his own ass.
Absolutely.
Which I love.
And I also...
There's sort of a strange integrity to like his sort of like debauchery. It's like, I can't
yeah.
lie about who I am.
Yeah.
He has no delusions about it. Well, no, he pretends to have delusions about who he is, but at the end he's like, no, I don't actually have any delusions.
Actually, yes. No, I was actually at the body house a minute ago. I love Mistress Quickly too.
She's so great.
So sassy. I just love her. I also love her confusion with the whole like when he's like, oh, go you thing go. And she's like, what thing? What thing? And he says something which on the surface is like a nice thing to say. Like,
yeah.
a thing to thank God on. And she's like, I am not. You know, it's like
yeah.
such a weird, like, her confusion. And then when he calls her a woman, she's like, I am not. Like,
yeah,
it's
like
just
her
such
MO
a great.
Like getting defensive.
Yeah.
It's very, very
so
charming.
Good. And then, of course, we can't forget the sexual innuendo of the thing.
Mm-hmm.
Say what thing, what thing.
An otter.
Yeah, an otter. Like, where does that come from?
And Hal's just like,
I love how Hal has been
otter?
Silent
really?
For quite a while, and then he's like, "An otter? Is that
like,
really
all
you've
you
got
say.
Going today?"
The honeymoon's
yeah.
kind of over between the two of them.
Yeah,
I don't know what happened between the last scene and this scene.
I do.
Where,
I will.
Where? Sorry.
I do. I will.
Is it that Hal embarrassed him in front of everyone? I don't mean between Falstaff and Hal. I mean between. Hostess Quickly.
Oh, Mistress
and
Quickly.
And Falstaff.
Oh.
What is it that happened? Because the next time we see the two of them together is going to be in part two when she's setting the constables on them.
Yeah.
Saying, like, no, you fucking owe me money.
Well, maybe it's this that he's both accused her of picking his pocket while he was asleep,
mm-hmm.
which the prince and Pito did. And on top of that, he owes her tons of money.
Yeah.
He owes her a lot of money.
I think the water's
yeah.
just like,
he's
yeah.
deflecting all of
yeah.
his sort of unease and you know,
yeah.
all of his baggage onto her. Like, oh, you!
Yeah.
I think he's doing a good job of like trying to take the negative energy off of himself.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
he's losing
totally.
That argument with Bardolph.
Yeah.
yeah.
So he kind of uses her as a scapegoat. In a
yeah.
way.
I love when he's like, back me up, Bardolph. And Bardolph is
like,
no,
nope.
no, you said that.
You said that.
You said that.
Like,
you said that.
Damn it. It's such a great moment. It's like, I have no one.
Is this the scene where he says, this house has turned, now is this house turned a body house?
Yeah, they pick pockets. Yeah.
They pick pockets. Do we maybe see the descent of the tavern from a bar and an inn to a whorehouse?
I always thought it just was a whorehouse, but that's...
She's like, I never.
Yeah.
But occasionally.
I thought it was a slight at this establishment.
Yeah.
That, like, it is just a tavern, but, like, oh, this is a body house. Well,
yeah.
my pocket's getting picked.
Mm.
Yeah.
I thought I just read it as Falstaff trying to discredit her as
yeah.
a barmaid and as a owner
yeah.
of an
yeah.
establishment.
Yeah.
I also love that the phrase stewed prune.
Yeah, you're a
there's
stewed
no
prune.
More faith in thee than in a stewed prune. Which is like, what?
Is anyone familiar with the Council of Elbows scene from Measure for Measure?
Yeah! Pruens.
Pompey goes in and out about stewed prunes.
Yeah.
There's something just like the term stewed prunes.
It's such a weird
phrase. Just delightful.
Well, and apparently, just to do the little note here, it was commonly available in brothels, and so it was also sort of known as a pimp or a whore.
Stewed prunes.
And the whole thing of like she in Measure for Measure,
yeah,
the whole thing of like she wanted stewed prunes.
Yeah,
like she's a horny slut, really. Is like what they're saying essentially. And it's like so weird.
I tell you,
such
she's
a weird
hoe.
She's a hoe.
Stewed prunes. Like four in the house.
Yeah,
I mean, you know,
she wanted them all.
She
so we've got to do Measure for Measure. It's such a good one.
Yeah,
I don't know Measure for Measure at all.
Great.
Some good
great
stuff.
Great stuff.
It's a difficult play.
That's
what
I
it's hear. It's a difficult.
Oh, it's a difficult play. It's a tough play to stage effectively.
Slings and arrows. Everyone watch it.
The otter bit.
Yeah,
she's
the
like,
otter.
Flesh, Amanda. That's like Falstaff being like, oh, I finally got one.
I got one good joke in today. Yeah. And then I love that Mistress Quickly gets defensive and in saying so makes herself the object of yet another joke when she's like, you know where to have me, you know?
Know.
And she's just like,
on
she's
other
like,
land or
so,
water. Yeah, so good.
So clueless. Like, I just love it. When people just sort of completely pass each other with meaning and like the meaning, like everyone else in the tavern, I love the idea that everyone else in the tavern is like, oh shit, look what
you
she just said.
Oh.
Yeah, exactly. And she like has no idea what she's saying is an innuendo. That's, I love that. I'm just remembering Jane's wonderful Midwest accent for Mistress Quickly.
Oh, she's
Quickly.
The hostess too?
Yeah, she was Henry the IV and the hostess. And
perfect.
She's so funny because her hostess was like, no, Sir John, you do not know me, Sir John. It was like this hilarious
choice.
Mad Midwest accent. It was so perfect.
It really was perfect.
It was so funny.
I would go on the record saying that. Thou art an unjust man in seeing so, thou or any man knows where to have me, thou knave, thou. It was really
so
tremendous.
Funny. Oh my god.
Falstaff was one of his moments of repentance here. Thou knowest in the state of innocency Adam fell, and what should poor Jack Falstaff do in the days of villainy?
So good.
You know?
I love that he always puts himself in, like, a biblical reference. He's like, well, you know, Adam was tempted in the age of innocence, so it's not my fault. Essentially, it's like his logic.
Yeah,
like,
he compares himself to Adam.
Yeah, he compares himself to Adam, and oh my god.
What
I also...
Company is what has spoiled me.
Yeah, I've been exposed. I wasn't innocent.
Company, villainous company.
Yeah. I was
I must
an innocent
give over
man.
This life.
It also, and it also harkens back to the first scene with him and Hal, where he's like, "Before I knew you, Hal, I knew nothing. I was innocent, and now am I little better than one of the wicked?" He's like blaming Hal for all of his vices, which I also just love. And my favorite Prince Hal line, possibly in the whole play, is when he's like, when Falstaff is like, "I pray God my girdle break," and Hal's like, oh, that would be disgusting. He's like, how would thy guts fall about thy knees? Like, I just love... It's such a, like, striking image to me of just, like, whatever was holding up his belly, just, like... And just, like... His gut is literally, like...
I totally blazed through that joke, but that is
at
so
his
good.
It's such a
Where
great
is it?
Image.
You should almost read it.
Line, like, 140-ish or 138 or so.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. 149-150. The king himself is to be feared as a lion.
Mm-hmm.
Dost thou think I'll fear thee as I fear thy God? Nay, if I do, I pray God my girdle break. Oh, if it should, how would thy guts fall about thy knees? It's like such a great
all the action
image.
Stops, like, oh, don't say that.
Oh, gross.
So fat.
Well, and he has the thing about Falstaff's knees. He says something in the other tavern scene.
How long
scene.
Is to go, Jack, since I saw thine own knee?
Yeah, how long ago was it when you saw your own knee? And I always love the idea that Falstaff is like, I've seen my... I haven't seen my knee
my
in a while.
You know, when I was that year,
an eagle's talon in the waist.
And any alderman's thumb ring.
I love
again,
all the fat jokes
that
in here.
A plague of sighing and grief.
It blows a man
up
like
a
bladder.
Bladder.
So good. Oh my god. I love all of the fat and skinny jokes in this play because when Hal starts insulting him and calling him fat and then Falstaff turns around and starts calling him thin in like the most insulting way possible. He's like, "You're a dry ox's penis." Like it's so intense. Like the names that they call each other. I'm like, man, we are so uncreative about our insults day and age.
There's a fun hour long it's a South Bank show and it's all in rehearsal videos of Matthew McFadden and Michael Gambon rehearsing with Nick Heitner in the room.
Oh my God.
And Nick Heitner goes on this bit about all those insults in Act 2, Scene 4. They're all penis insults.
Yeah.
And they're not just you're skinny, they're you got a tiny dick. You know?
That's brilliant.
You got an unbelievably small penis.
Well, that's like the song, there's a rap song called, I think it's just called My Dick.
By Frankie Avalon?
Yeah, My Dick is the HIV, HP free. Yo dick got the HIV.
Yeah. That's exactly
my dick. Bigger than a bridge. Yo dick looks like a little kid's. My dick is extra supersized. Yo dick looks like just two fries.
It's terrific.
It's time that we let the world know. Dude, you gotta let your girl go. DX is the best in the business. P.S. We got dicks like Jesus.
Oh, God.
For those of you following at home.
Amazing. That is our modern
like
equivalent.
Jesus. It's so good.
Amazing.
They offend none but the virtuous.
They offend none but the virtuous.
To quote Falstaff. So good. But also, okay, so the other thing that I just wanted to say is that it's really clear to me in this scene that everyone has to go to war, right?
Yeah.
Everyone. So it's not just Falstaff and Hal. It's Peto and Bardolph and everyone. Like, they all have to go off to war. And I think that's something that we kind of don't really have that in our sort of cultural ethos anymore because we don't have the draft.
Yeah.
We haven't had it in a while. But that it's quite an idea that literally everyone was just called upon to serve. It was just seen as like part of your duty as an Englishman to fight for your king. And as we'll see in Act 5, they were really, a lot of them, food for powder. You know, they were just there to die. So it's a huge, that's why I think this scene has to sort of take like a really melancholy turn, because I think most of them know they're not coming back. They probably must know that.
Yeah.
And that's something very, I don't think we really have that kind of thing in our culture anymore that much.
Today, no.
Yeah. I mean,
not in this country.
Not in this country. There is actually a fun little side story, which is the only thing I can think of that sort of relates to this, is there's a pub, which claims to be the oldest pub in New York City, in the East Village, called McSorley's.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great place. There's like sawdust on the floor. It's like a really cool place. They only serve two kinds of beer, and they make both the beers there. And it's been there since the 1800s. And what they used to do was, for the soldiers who were going off to war, they would get a chicken. They would like get a roast chicken, and then they would get the wishbone, and they would hang the wishbone on the chandelier. And if they came back, they would take it off. But there's a lot of them that are still there because they didn't come back. And the health department in New York was like trying to get them to get rid of these for so long, and they put up this huge fight. But if you go in there, you can still see there's like
That's
dozens
cool.
and dozens of these wishbones, just
yeah.
like super dusty and like absolutely disgusting, but you're like, somebody put that there and they didn't come back and get it, you know. And that's the only sort of modern equivalent that I can think of that sort of has to do with like New York specifically. But it's a, it's kind of haunting,
that's,
you know.
Cool.
It's like this space that, you know, I would love to do something like that if I were to stage this, you know,
yeah,
have something like where they were leaving something in order to come back and get it, you know. Just to add to that. Anyway, did anyone have any other thoughts about Act 3 before we move on to Act 4? Okay, great. Well, thank you so much for listening, and tune in next week as we move on to Act 4 of King Henry IV, Part 1.